Okay, so good morning, everybody. And I hope that we are all settling in together by now and you're settling into your bodies and your mind, maybe your meditation object, whatever that may be, and hopefully starting to enjoy the practice. So this morning I wanted to talk about how to enjoy breath meditation. I don't know if anybody does enjoy breath meditation. Anyone? Yes? Wow. Sort of. Anyone struggle with breath meditation? Yeah, that's honest. It's not the easiest, right? It's not the easiest. So today we're going to have a look at why it is sometimes difficult, how we can bring a bit more enjoyment to it, and some of the ways to start really getting into the happiness of meditation, the troubleshooting guide to bliss. Does that sound good? Okay, all right. It's not only that, Mara, but it's mostly that. So I wanted to start with a little recap from yesterday's teaching on the gradual training, because this is one of the keys to success in any kind of meditation. So if you remember yesterday, Ajahn Nito talked about how the gradual training begins, and it starts when we hear the teachings of the Buddha, as simple as that. We hear the Dhamma, hopefully close to how the Buddha taught it. I mean, we can come in through different ways to the path and the practice of meditation. But when we hear the Buddha's teachings, because it's coming from somebody who experienced these things for themselves, and it's described so perfectly, so clearly, in a way that gives us a map and gives us the inspiration to practice, we gain that inspiration. We gain the confidence that, yes, this is a path worth following. And if we follow this path, it's going to lead somewhere really incredible, really productive of wisdom, of compassion, and of the great insights which can really transform our lives. So we get this confidence, and that motivates us to walk on the path. You know, the Buddha said that the human life is very precious. We're in the most incredible position to be able to understand the Dhamma and actually put it into practice. And so we realize what an incredible opportunity we have, and we make a resolution to walk on this path to the best of our ability. And sometimes the more we practice, the more we realize that it's less to do with an ability and much more to do with conditions. So then the emphasis becomes on creating those conditions for the practice to really take off and to flourish and to deepen throughout our lives. So one of the ways this starts to manifest is by observing very good ethics, starting to get clearer on our values, the things we really hold dear and hold high above our heads, maybe things like kindness, harmlessness, giving, serving, doing things for ourselves and other people. So these are some of the values that we start to actually live. And the more we live this, the more benefit we experience. And this gives us even more confidence. So it's like a beautiful kind of feedback loop that is just getting more and more joy and more confidence as we go. You could call it, instead of the vicious circle, a virtuous circle of happiness. And from that sila, we take it even further. We're not only concerned with our acts of body and speech, but also the way our mind works. And this is what we call sense restraint. Often it's translated as sense restraint, but the actual Pali is Indriya Sambhava Sila, or Indriya, Samvara Sila. Indriya Samvara Sila, which means the virtue of guarding the senses. So it's a kind of virtue as well, like the way we use our senses, the way we perceive the world. Are we perceiving it in ways that leads to wholesome states increasing? Or are we perceiving people, ourselves, situations in ways that makes us angry and upset? So we start to be able to have some kind of, I wouldn't say control, but kind of influence and skill with our mind and with our mental states. And all of this, the external virtue, the inner virtue, the confidence, the joy that starts to arise, starts to undermine those very coarse hindrances. you know, things like overt anger and hatred and very strong sensual lust or pleasure in the senses and going about things in unskillful ways. So at this stage in the practice, it's almost like there's a simile in the Buddhist teachings about refining gold and melting it down. At this stage, we've not started to necessarily melt the gold yet, but it's like we've seen all the other kind of impurities of the gold and we've put them to one side. So we have the tin, the copper, the lead, and all of this is like clear to us, right? So we know what to pick up and what not to pick up. And so we have this gold. We have a mind that's reasonably happy, that's reasonably content, and that is fit to go a bit deeper. And then what we want to do is take this gold and melt it down so we can remove even the fine hindrances. And this is where breath meditation and any other kind of meditation can come in. So we already have some understanding of our mind, of the kind of different qualities, positive and afflictive, we could say. And then we know where we can begin. We have some kind of capacity to start working with that gold and melting it down. So breath meditation becomes a vehicle to help us refine our mind much more and eventually gain much deeper insight and deeper states of bliss. So I wanted to give you a little story about how this teaching, the Anapanasati Sutta, which is found in the Majjhima Nikaya number 118, for any sutta enthusiasts, how it actually begins. Because I find this quite encouraging, and I just looked at it again recently, and there's a little story as to how it begins. So the Buddha actually begins the sutta by praising the people he's sitting in front of. So should I do the same? So he says, this assembly is free from prattle. Prattle, like just rubbish, basically, talking rubbish. And free from chatter, just kind of useless speech. It consists of heartwood. It's worthy of gifts, hospitality, reverence, and respect. The people that he's sitting in front of are an incomparable field of merit, such that a small gift given to them becomes great, and a great gift becomes even greater still. Such an assembly is rare and worth journeying to see. Yesterday we said, didn't we, what if everybody here got enlightened? Do you think there'd be like TV crews and people that couldn't wait to give you gifts? No? No, they might not even believe it, huh? Even if the Buddha came to the airport. I don't know if anybody would care. But hopefully they would. And in the Buddha's day, he said, you know, people were very, very inspired and would come and give such assemblies gifts. So who was this assembly? Who were the people that he was teaching this to? And you won't be surprised to know that it consisted of the four kinds of enlightened person, the four kinds of noble beings. So that's the stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and fully enlightened beings. But also, there were those devoted to establishing the four satipatthanas. That means the four focuses of mindfulness. Basically, it's people devoted to developing very strong mindfulness into the areas of existence that we consider are ours. We assume a sense of self lies there. Also, there were people cultivating the eight enlightenment factors. So we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about that in a couple of days, what these eight enlightenment factors are. Also, there were people developing the four Brahma-viharas, that's loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy or altruistic joy, and equanimity. And also, there were people who were devoted to mindfulness of breathing in that assembly. So there you go. You're already worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of great respect, because you are devoted to these practices, to some of these practices. So why did the Buddha have such high praise for people like us? And I think it's because these practices lead to becoming a noble being. These practices are ennobling practices. You're walking the path that the Buddha walked. And breath meditation was the Buddha's favorite meditation, as far as we understand, and the one that he actually practiced when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree before his awakening. So breath meditation is incredibly important, and it has certain benefits. One of the first benefits the Buddha mentioned was vitakka upachedaya, which means it is effective in overcoming thinking. Does that sound nice? Ah, alas, the mind actually stops chattering and prattling to itself. So breath meditation is one of the best practices for this. And the Buddha was known as the silent sage, the great silent one. So silence is a very important part of the practice. And of course, silence leads to ever deepening stillness, to the deep states of meditation, the jhanas. The Buddha also called breath meditation a pleasant abiding here and now. Notice the word pleasant. So if your breath meditation is a struggle, if you're using lots of force, it's most probably because the foundations have not been fully established yet. It's not because there's anything wrong with you. It's most probably the fact that you're going to the breath too soon, before you've really developed enough inner happiness through the other parts of the path. So if you move on to the breath and the mind's just like rejecting the breath, or it only wants to see it for like 1.2 seconds and then it's off somewhere else, just focus on those foundations again. Develop some joy, develop some loving kindness perhaps first of all. And just when the time comes that you feel like trying out this breath meditation, instead of going out and grabbing that breath, just gently invite the breath in. Or ask the mind, mind, do you want to see the breath? Would you like to meet the breath right now? Nah, I'm not interested in that. I want to do something else. Fine, that's okay, mind. We'll try again later. So we're very, very gentle with our mind. And this means that we actually start to enjoy the practice. And it's supposed to be pleasant. The context for this particular teaching came from a very dramatic event that occurred in the Buddha's time. Yesterday in the Q&A, we were talking about vanity a little bit. And I think one of the students here mentioned that there are some practices in the Buddhist texts that teach us to see the body in its kind of bare blood and bone form, let's say. So we actually dissect the body mentally into skin, teeth, nails, hair. And then if you dare, you can go a bit deeper. Flesh, blood, bones, snot, feces, urine, and all of this. And this kind of method was used to overcome a lot of lust, basically, particularly among monastics whose, you know, whole life depends on them being celibate, right? You can't be a good monastic if you're not celibate. And it's actually a disrobing offence to engage in any kind of sexual activity. So it's very, very critical that lust doesn't take over the mind. But in the Buddha's day, these monks, I think, were practicing this kind of meditation. It's called meditation on the loathsome nature of the body, right? And the aim is to bring us to a kind of balanced perspective that this body is nothing more than flesh, blood, bone. It's not supposed to make us hate the body at all. But at that time, the Buddha wasn't present. And they were practicing in a very extreme way, to the point that they started getting so much hatred towards their body that they actually started committing suicide in quite large numbers. So that when the Buddha came back from his retreat, he said to his main disciple, his chief attendant, Ananda, he said, Ananda, why is the assembly so diminished? And you can just see the Buddha kind of looking perplexed. It shows he didn't always know what was happening, right? So he's not omniscient, as people like to imagine. And Ananda told the Buddha, well, they were practicing this meditation on loathsomeness, and some people took their own lives. Other people sought for someone else to kill them. And all this terrible tragedy unfolded during this time he was away, and the Buddha's solution was to instead teach anapana meditation, teach breath meditation. So he taught breath meditation because it was a pleasant practice to do. So another benefit, and this is really great, is that if you practice breath meditation, it actually completes the four focuses of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, and the eight enlightenment, or seven, sorry. Why have I put eight down? I'm sure it's seven enlightenment factors. Eightfold Noble Path, seven enlightenment factors. We can have an extra one if you want. So it's a three-in-one method. All you have to do, as well as the gradual training, of course, the foundation of virtue in particular is very important. All you need to do is watch the breath in the correct way. Yeah? And this breath meditation can take you all the way through the path right to liberation. So what are some of the advantages of breath meditation? And one of the most obvious advantages straight away is that the breath is always with us. It's always here. From the time we're born to the time we die, we're breathing. I remember a story where someone said to Ajahn Chah, I don't have time to meditate. You know, I just don't have time. What can I do? You need time to meditate. He said, well, do you have time to breathe? Do you have time to breathe, anyone? So the object of the breath is always right there. And the other beautiful thing is that it's a part of this body and mind. It's part of our emotional world as well, and we can learn a lot about our mental state through noticing the breath. The breath also has a sense of immediacy to it. It's always happening now. How many times do you sit and fantasize about the breath in the past? I hope that'd be kind of weird, wouldn't it? Or you like fantasize about the kind of breath that might arise in the future. The breath is something that only makes sense in the present moment. And because of this, the Buddha actually said it's a very powerful form of death meditation as well. We can reflect on the in-breath that this could be our last breath. On the out-breath, we don't know if the next breath's coming in. Right? The breath is always happening now. And you're not only aware of the fact that the breath is happening, but you can be aware of parts of the breath as it's happening. So the breath has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. What are the other advantages? Yeah, the other main advantage I wanted to share is that the breath acts like a bridge. And this is very important. It acts like a bridge between awareness of our bodies and awareness of our mind. So it takes us from body contemplation, because the breath is part of the body, all the way to our mind. We actually go beyond the breath. So the breath becomes a vehicle for the most extraordinary journey beyond the body into the realm of the mind, and going into new territory that we've never explored before. Sometimes very subtle territory, sometimes with picturesque scenery, sometimes maybe it's a little bit scary because you're leaving the known shore, you're leaving one side of the river and going to the next, or maybe it feels like a huge shore and you have to cross an enormous lake, you know, and you don't know what you're going to find on the way. And this is a very interesting part of the practice when we start to get into the realm of the mind and our perceptions start to change. So I'll get more into that when we go into the sutta itself. But it's really a development of perception. And we go through different perceptions that we may not have experienced before. So, for example, we start to notice the breath through the body sense door. So we feel it as sensations. Yeah, first of all, maybe the temperature, maybe the texture, whether it's long or short, but we feel it with the body. We feel it as a physical bodily sensation. And later on, we start to feel it as something different. Maybe we feel the softness of the breath, or maybe we start to feel the breath has a kind of shimmer or a kind of glow. And this is the same breath, but it's starting to be experienced more through feeling, but mental feeling at this point. And later on, we actually start to feel it purely through the mind. So this is when lights and things like this start to happen in the mind. If they come in the sort of correct sequence, so to say, as a result of breath meditation, they sort of born from within the breath, if you like, those lights are actually just a mental representation of the breath. It's the way the mind knows the breath. So it's a very, very different perception. And of course, it's not actually a light. It's not actually something you're seeing with your eyes at all. It's still the breath, but it's the breath known through the mind. Actually, the perception of breath has disappeared by now, but you're still in that realm. It's still considered breath meditation at this point. So anyway, lest we get too far ahead of ourselves, I wanted to go to the sutta itself and talk about how these experiences manifest, and also talk about how the description of the progress of breath meditation is just that. It's a description. It's what happens naturally. It's not steps we need to perform or we need to get right. It's not prescriptive. It's not saying first do this, then do this, then next do this. It's actually describing a natural journey. It's describing the terrain. And it'll happen slightly differently for all of us, but this is the basic sequence of what occurs in the mind. And in this little excerpt that I have in this wonderful book, The Word of the Buddha, which is a translation by Ajahn Brahm, it just starts straight away with the tetrads, with the description of the different kinds of breath meditation, the different stages of breath meditation. But in the whole sutta, it actually talks about some prerequisites, first of all. And one of the first ones, of course, is to go to a secluded place and to sit comfortably. So yay, you've already done that. You're already in a secluded place, and I hope you're sitting comfortably. So if you're not, please do. And then the next thing is to establish mindfulness. Yeah, so mindfulness has already been established through the gradual training to some extent. We don't have to just conjure it up out of nowhere. We've already been developing mindfulness of the body postures, mindfulness of our conduct, of body, speech and mind. And now we take that mindfulness and we establish it as a priority before we start the breath meditation. So the important thing here is the order that we establish mindfulness first, but also the kind of mindfulness that we establish, okay? So it's not just being mindful, what we call bare awareness, B-A-R-E. It's actually mindfulness with kindness infused within it. That's called B-E-A-R awareness, which some of us are very good at. So mindfulness along with kindness. This is mindfulness along with the right attitude. And it's almost like mindfulness with kindness within it has a kind of virus control. So it has an antidote within it against those subtle hindrances like ill will. So in the first meditation we did when you arrived, I talked about it being like the light and the warmth of the sun. This is one of Ajahn Brahm's really beautiful similes. So the mindfulness is like the light of the sun and the kindness is like the warmth. So you don't have one without the other, right? When the sun shines, it's usually warm, unless you're really in the sort of far northern mountains of Norway. Maybe it's still a bit chilly, but there's a warmth to the sun. And in the same way, there needs to be a warmth to our mindfulness, a caring, unconditional kind of awareness. And also, mindfulness has a certain purpose. So it's not just that we're mindful of anything, but we're mindful as well to keep unwholesome states away. Yeah? Maybe I'll tell that story later, unless it's already been told. So anyway, there's another story coming later in another talk. But basically, what we want to do is keep out the enemies to our meditation. So spot them early on. If you spot ill will arising or boredom or sleepiness, notice it. And the sooner you notice it, the quicker it can be kind of snubbed out. So this is one way to actually prevent the so-called enemies coming in. It's like you have a bouncer on your mind, noticing if the riffraff get too close and kind of keeping them out. But the other really powerful way to do this is inviting lots of friends inside. So this means having lots of beautiful states inside your mind, so much so that those enemies can't come in. So this means having states like loving kindness, maybe contentment, perhaps a softness of mind. Yeah. A softness that can actually absorb the breath. It can actually receive the breath. The breath doesn't just kind of come in and bounce straight out, as it does when the mind is hard, when the mind's defensive or just not prepared. So we have the mindfulness that guards the mind. And mindfulness should always be in the present moment. It's not really mindfulness if it's of the past. So this is Ajahn Brahm's kind of present moment awareness that he begins every meditation with. We learn to just put the past and the future down for a while. And sometimes we have to sort of convince ourselves that we're safe to do this, right? You have to sort of allow yourself to know that you can pick it up again later. But now is your meditation time. Now the only thing that makes sense is to be in the present moment. And the breath is going to help us with that. So mindfulness of the present moment can be a perception that you develop before breath meditation. But when the breath starts to come into the mind, it will help you get even closer to that very, very present moment awareness that is not tight, but is very soft and expansive in a way. And then lastly, the mindfulness needs to be silent. So in the beginning, of course, there's still some chatter, there's still some movement of the mind. But again, the breath meditation, bit by bit, helps us to quieten the mind. And then the mindfulness can really grow strong. So, shall we go to the sutta itself and have a look at what comes next? So we've already gone to a quiet place. We've established mindfulness in front of us. We've allowed our minds to be soft, to be filled with good qualities. Maybe we've practiced a bit of loving kindness first, as we tried to do yesterday. And then we go to the breath. So this is straight from the Anapanasati Sutta. As I said, it's the Majjhima number 118. And this is Ajahn Brahm's translation. And the way he's translated it is interesting because he's made it more clear that this is a description rather than a sequence of instructions. So how does mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, complete true knowledge and deliverance? How does it complete the four focuses of mindfulness? So this is the first tetrad, and this is about the breath felt through the body. So number one, when the in-breath and out-breath are long, you are aware that they are long. Okay? So you're just aware. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. So it doesn't say breathe in a long breath or breathe out a short breath or watch the breath. Have you noticed that? It doesn't tell you to watch the breath. Even I find myself saying that sometimes, when you watch the breath, blah, blah, blah. But the Buddha's not asking you to watch the breath. He's saying that when the in-breath and out-breath are long, or when the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they're long. You're aware that they're short. That's all. It's the awareness that's key. So we establish that awareness, that loving, unconditional awareness, and then we simply experience the breath. So here I want to stop a little bit because there are some tricks, okay? And sometimes these aren't taught very much, but it's interesting to know that our teacher Ajahn Brahm, who is a kind of master of meditation, I mean, he's been practicing for so many years and had some very good results, even in his first retreat. So these days he tends to teach that you just do nothing and the breath either comes or it doesn't, and there's nothing much you can do once you're sitting on your cushion, that is. But in the very beginning of his meditation, he did used to gently count the breath. So this is one method you can use if you have some awareness of the breath, if the mind is more or less ready to watch the breath, but you just need a little bit more support, a little bit more help with getting onto that breath and sustaining your focus on it, or sustaining the interest in it, perhaps we could say. So sometimes I've tried this in my earlier years, and I actually had good results. But the trick was to still be aware of the breath first and foremost, and to just use counting very, very gently, very, very subtly, so that the meditation doesn't just become like 1, 2, 3, 4, 21, 27, 8, and you're all over the place, okay, because this can happen. So what I find quite helpful is to just breathe in once, breathe out, and at the very end of the out breath, one, very gently, and then allow the next breath to come in, the end of the next breath, two, very gently. And you can do this, say, up to five. And then the next time you can do the same thing, maybe up to six. The next time, up to seven. And if you get lost, you have to start again. So it gives you a little bit of something to do in the beginning. But see that the counting doesn't become very strong and overpowering of the breath. The main thing is that you're aware of breathing. You're aware of the breath coming in, going out, and then you can make a very gentle count just so that you know you're on track. And if you do it in this subtle way, it's quite interesting because you can try and find the exact point where the out-breath stops. Or maybe you want to count on the in-breath. You can find the exact place that the in-breath stops. And that way you're starting to come closer to a continuity of breathing. So this is just the very first stage of breath meditation. And it's what we call the vitakka, which means the mind pointing to the object. The mind is continually being directed to the object. And the breath just helps with that. And generally, we feel the breath at this point, so it can actually be helpful to notice, for example, the temperature of the breath or whether the breath is rough or smooth. You could also notice whether the in-breath is longer than the out-breath is longer than the in-breath, and all the different feelings of the breath. But it is really helpful not to locate the breath in any particular part of the body. So we want to feel the breath, not the body or the body part where the breath is touching. Of course, that will be there in the beginning, but we just don't give it too much importance, right? So you sort of let that perception fall off the screen. And this is where perception starts to be really important in the practice. And it's almost like with this first stage of just the in and the out breath, it's like noticing, say, a wave coming in and out of the shore. So you just notice the waves come in, the waves gone out. Now it's come in, now it's gone out. And then quite naturally, the next stage will happen. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. So this is when you're not only aware that it's now come in and it's now gone out, but you're aware of the whole breath coming in for the whole duration and the whole breath going out. And this is what's known as vichara. This is when the mind actually sustains attention on the breath. So the attention is actually being sustained for longer periods. And this is similar to watching the whole of the wave coming in, the whole of the wave going out. At this point, it's almost like you could imagine yourself maybe surfing the wave. Or maybe you could imagine yourself, if you're not a surfer, lying on some kind of floating thing, and just feeling that whole wave as it comes up and goes down. So the mind is starting to really rest in the breath. And because of this, it starts to become increasingly peaceful. And you start to develop the fourth stage. And the next one is when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. So here it's important to note that you're not really doing the calming. The calming is happening on its own because the mind is getting more peaceful. And because of that, you don't need so much oxygen. It's as simple as that, right? When you're really relaxed, when you're really peaceful, the breath just becomes really calm and quiet. And it happens as a matter of course. Yeah. So at this time, the mind is calm, the breath is calm, and it's like those waves are subsiding, 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 and becoming really smooth. Yeah. If you would be calming the breath on purpose, it'd be like kind of going up to those waves and patting them. Come on, waves, you know, be calm. Or trying to hold them in from the side of the shore. Stop coming in and out. You know, that makes absolutely no sense. And it's just going to agitate the water even more. So instead, it's just a natural part of the process and the breath starts to calm. And the mind, as a result, gets more subtle, more sensitive, and more nuanced in a way. So you feel more of the breath and you start to enjoy the process. Okay? So the physical aspect of the breath is becoming much more subtle at this point. And then comes the second tetrad. Oh, sorry, no, there's a little bit more to this, okay? Because the way Ajahn Brahm's translated is when you learn to do these things. So I'll just recap. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they're long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they're short. And when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, and when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions, you're mindful of the body. Having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. Sometimes this is translated as the breath is regarded as a body within the body, something like that. So the breath is like a body of breath within the body. So you can, in other words, regard the breath like a body in and of itself. That is why on this occasion, a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, that means aware of the purpose of what you're doing and why, and mindful. So by now we're very calm, and then it goes into the next tetrad, and this is the most important in many ways. Ajahn Brahm calls this one the pivot point of meditation, and I like to call it the happiness tetrad. So this is where happiness starts to arise. And in a sense, this tetrad is almost the link between feeling the breath with the body and starting to feel the breath with the mind. And you'll see why shortly. So the first one, when you learn to experience joy, piti, as you breathe in and out. Second, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out. Okay, so I'm going to stop here because we're still in feeling the breath, but now we're starting to feel the feelings of the breath and the beautiful feelings. So in some suttas in the Buddha's teachings, we're asked also to experience unpleasant sensations, or there's a teaching that we can learn to experience pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, and remain equanimous, develop equanimity. But in this particular teaching, there's no mention of unpleasant sensations at all. The Buddha talks about feeling, about Vedana, in this particular section, but he only talks about pleasant Vedana, pleasant feelings, piti and sukha, rapture and a kind of internal contentment and inner happiness. So this is really key to enjoying the meditation. When the joy starts to come up in the breath, it's so easy to be with. It's so easy to stay with. You don't want to go anywhere else. We were saying in the questions recently, you know, that piti sukha, this joy and happiness that arises from the mind, from the meditation practice, is an antidote to all those other hindrances. But how can it be an antidote if we haven't got there yet? Now we get to this point through breath meditation, and it's much harder for the hindrances to disturb the mind. But there are still a few hindrances, and there are still a few things that can prevent this joy and bliss from arising in the mind. So it's arising because we're overcoming the hindrances. It's arising because the mindfulness is starting to develop, starting to grow, and our minds are getting energized. But what do you do if it doesn't arise? Has anyone been practicing breath meditation for a long time and not had that joy arise? So, yeah, it doesn't always arise, right? Sometimes it may. So there are reasons for that, and it's important to investigate at this time, perhaps not necessarily in the meditation itself, but certainly outside of it. So we want to understand what it is and where this piti sukha comes from. Most of the time, the joy arises when wholesome attitudes are present. And to me, the most wholesome attitudes you can possibly develop are really about contentment. Contentment is almost like the antidote to every hindrance. If we're contented with the breath as it is, you say it's not pleasant, but if you can find that it's pleasant enough and genuinely develop that perception, this is good enough, this is so easy, it's just breath. All the coarse suffering that I experience in my daily life is gone. All I have to do is to breathe and just develop this sense of contentment with the breath, then the breath actually starts to appear beautiful. It's also gratitude towards the breath can be a very powerful way to develop joy. Things that you feel grateful towards, you tend to enjoy being around. People that you're grateful to, you enjoy their company, right? So gratitude and contentment with the breath. However, if it is still not arising, number one, you're not going to like this antidote. Patience. Patience. The Buddha says that patience is the highest spiritual quality. Kanti paramam tapo titika. It means patience is the supreme spiritual quality. And the reason for that, I think, is because it gives time for the other wholesome qualities to develop. So we have to be patient, but patient in the correct way. I was saying to somebody in the interviews yesterday that patience doesn't mean waiting for something to happen later. Patience means being so patient that you're happy to stay right where you are, right in the center of your experience, right in the present moment, so patient that you don't even think about things changing. You don't even want things to change. You're just incredibly patient to be where you are right now with that good kamma attitude, that contentment, that loving kindness, that sense of gratitude. So patience is very important. If you've been practicing for years and years and years and you think you've been patient to the highest degree, check out your virtue. Check out your virtuous conduct in your daily life. This is really important. Maybe your virtuous conduct of body of speech is pretty good, but maybe it's mostly on the I don't do the bad things, right? How many of the good things do you do? Can you actually protect life? Can you be more tender with the people around you? Can you be more generous, not only in terms of supporting the Norwegian Buddhist Society and the Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project, but generous with your time, generous with the way you think about others, generous with taking care of yourself. Can you do this? Can you develop more wholesome states? And how about the sense restraint? What are you allowing into your mind? Are you allowing yourself to get irritated by other people's perceived faults? Is there another way you can perceive situations and experiences? Giving people the benefit of the doubt, looking for their good qualities. So all these are an aspect of sila, and something I still neglect to do, and I do so much good, and I feel genuinely happy about it, but I still neglect to really contemplate it. And the Buddha said that whatever wholesome deeds we do, we should actually bring it up in our mind when we start to meditate. So this is another thing you can do at the beginning of your meditation, as well as loving kindness, is to bring up the beautiful things that you've done in your life. What has your life been in service of so far? And how are you trying to develop in your life? What kind of qualities are you trying to cultivate in your heart? Isn't that amazing? When there are so many influences outside that ask us to hate one another, to divide from one another, to see other people as different and problematic, and we're so committed to harmony, We're so committed to goodness, to kindness, to love. This is extraordinary. So bring these things up, even small things you've done throughout the day, or small bad things that you haven't done, that you could have done, things you could have said that you restrained. So bring this up. It's called Chaganusati or Silanusati, recollection of one's own virtue, one's own goodness, one's own generosity. And the Buddha said it's very important. I know that when Ajahn Brahm was building his monastery in the early days, like in the 80s, sort of end of the 80s, and doing a lot of work, building and sleeping pretty rough, he used to have very little time for meditation, but the time he did have, he would always begin with Silanusati, recollecting the goodness that he was doing and why. You have to recollect the purpose, yeah? We're doing this for spreading the Dhamma. You know, in my monastery, I have a ton of admin. It can seem really tiresome, really worldly, very mundane compared to my former life in the forests. But when I remember what it's all about, and when I get, you know, emails from people saying that it's changing their life or it saved their life. I mean, it happens all the time. I thought that kind of thing only happened to Ajahn Brahm. It happens to me almost once a day. Maybe not life-changing, but almost every day I'm getting messages from people that are saying just that I cannot imagine how much it means. Just that there's someone sharing the Dhamma and living the life of a nun. And it's just incredibly rewarding for me. So I'm sure that many of you are doing amazingly good things. I told my mother once, you know, don't you think about what you did in your career? She was a speech and language therapist working with adults in learning disabilities, with learning disabilities, and managing a whole faculty of professionals who looked after them. And, you know, like most people, sometimes she suffered quite a lot of not really depression, but kind of, you know, feeling a bit unsatisfied and bogged down, dragged down by the problems in the world. And I said, you know, just think about your life and the way you've really made a difference. And she was quite taken aback. Nobody had ever suggested that to her before. So see if you can do this. And this is going to bring you more happiness in your life. And the happiness is going to arise more easily in your meditation. When you have that sense that, yes, I'm doing well, I'm doing good. Another thing to troubleshoot, and this is a tender one and one that's very common, I think, is to check your attitude, not only towards the meditation, but also towards yourself. One of our attitudes towards meditation, it can be that we're looking for something special, right? We're looking for a kind of firework kind of bliss or something really intense, something like, I don't know, what do they say, a bliss better than sex? So you're looking for this kind of huge hit. And the reason it's better is not because it's necessarily very intense, it can be, but it's because it's peaceful as well. So look for that quiet, subtle kind of joy, because that's how it begins. And I remember being on retreat in Perth once, and I was quite peaceful, but nothing special, nothing special. And then I remembered this instruction from Ajahn Brahm, notice peace, or it might have been notice bliss. And the words just came in my mind. I didn't do anything. And suddenly it was almost like tuning into like a different frequency of the mind that I now believe is probably always there. But it was just about noticing it. It wasn't there before, but suddenly it was. And as soon as I could recognize it, and I recognized it as mental bliss, not physical, it just blew up in the mind. The whole mind was completely immersed in this bliss. It was really incredible. And the first time I'd experienced something like that. And it just came from the simple change in perception, from thinking something was reasonably average peace to suddenly overwhelming bliss. So just check your expectation. You're not looking for that type of bliss, but perhaps what you're already experiencing is more nourishing than you realize. And you're just looking for something that's not there instead of noticing what is. Another thing that can happen, other than looking for sort of special experiences, is that we do feel happiness. We do start to experience joy, but we think we don't deserve it. Or we get afraid, yeah? I see some people nodding already. We think, oh, no, not for me. this is good for other people, but I haven't worked hard enough for this. Or I'm only a beginner, this shouldn't be happening. Ooh, this is a bit, I feel a bit out of control. Because actually, yeah, the mind is becoming powerful and the practice is happening now kind of itself. You've reached this so-called tipping point in meditation and your karma, if you like, all that good karma, all those good intentions you've been planting, all the sila, listening to the Dhamma, is starting to manifest with results. And this is the happiness that's coming up. And just like, you know, we can't control pain in the body, we can't control happiness either. It makes no sense to try. It's just nature. And it's something we need to learn to gain a certain amount of steadiness with. Yeah? Another thing that can come up when we do experience happiness, and especially if it's, you know, quite intense, is we get a bit excited. It's like you've just got a fast motor car or something, or maybe one of those snow machines. I don't know if that was a real one, but anyway, I saw a little thing outside the back with wheels and it looked like you'd go through the snow on it. It looked really fun. And then I thought, ooh, I don't know, that'd be really cool to try, but if you went a bit too fast or it went out of control, you'd be in trouble. So in the same way, you know, it's like having a new kind of vehicle, maybe a fast car or a really cool snowmobile. Am I making this up, or other things like snowmobiles? There are, okay. And you don't know how to handle it. You just don't know. So you get kind of a bit anxious, a bit nervous, a bit gung-ho, and you go too fast and you crash. So in the same way, if excitement starts to come up, just see if you can stay steady. If you need to, it's okay to still, you know, steady the mind with the breath. At this point, the breath hasn't completely vanished. So you can still use the breath as this very stabilizing kind of place to rest. And you just allow these feelings to start coming up in the background, so to speak. And sooner or later, when the mind is stable enough, then they will grow gradually, gradually into very beautiful states. And yes, I think we've said enough about contentment and also loving kindness. And to make a practice of loving kindness in your daily life. Because if the happiness is not coming up in breath meditation, it may be that, you know, other kinds of meditation are more effective for you in generating that joy. And loving kindness is a meditation that develops joy and happiness relatively quickly, relatively early on. Yeah. One of the reasons is because it substitutes on unwholesome thoughts. So it's a very direct antidote to ill will. But also just that, you know, it's this act of giving. It's this act of sharing goodwill. And that giving, that movement of giving, is a kind of letting go. So you're gaining right attitude as well. You're getting this sense of selflessness in your practice. You're not just in it for you. So try to do loving kindness several times throughout the day, even if it's not your main meditation object. And that is going to help you enormously, not only to experience joy, but also to get familiar with it, and to free the mind from that very tenacious hindrance of ill will, which can get into our breath meditation. Sometimes it manifests as boredom or just dulling out, or, you know, I think boredom is very common, isn't it, with breath meditation, especially before the joy arises. It's like, oh, this breath, okay, big deal, coming in, going out. So see if you can raise the happiness in other parts of your practice. Okay, so the next part is where we start to move to the mind. When you learn to experience the mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and breathe out. And when you learn to calm this mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out. So for me, this is where you start to feel the joy and the pleasure less through the body and more through the mind. It's a shift that's subtle but quite clear. When it happens, you know, in the beginning, the piti sukha comes up and you can kind of feel it in the body. The whole body feels tingly, for example. Or it's like you have this joy in the mind, but it still has the sort of shape of the body in the background. But at this point, you're really the mind is gaining so much power, it starts to kind of overshadow the body and the body sense gets more remote. So the piti sukha is born of the mind. And then it naturally calms down when you've had enough or not really had enough, but when you've been sort of satiated with that piti sukha and you've got used to that intensity of happiness, naturally the mind starts to incline towards a quieter kind of joy. It just happens on its own. The agitating part of it starts to fade away and you're left with something very, very smooth, very, very nourishing, very, very still. And on those occasions, you're mindful of experience. So Ajahn Brahm's translation of Vedana here is experience. Having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. For being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience or feeling Vedana. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. So that completes the second satipatthana. We've done the body contemplation and now we've contemplated feelings, pleasant feelings. And next we move to the mind. And now it's already 10 o'clock. Oh, what are we going to do? This is the juicy bit. Shall I just read through this and say what it means? Yes? You have enough energy left? Okay. So the next one is when we move from feeling the breath, even feeling the breath mentally, to knowing the breath. Okay? So now it's a purely mental experience. When you learn to experience the citta, the mind, and in brackets, Ajahn Brahm has put it very clearly, experiencing a nimitta. So this is where we have maybe a light in the mind, but it can be a feeling nimitta. But it's still a mental nimitta. It's still a mental experience. As you breathe in and out. Most commonly, this is experienced as a light in the mind. Sometimes when these things start to arise, they can come kind of and just flash in, flash out. Or sometimes people have like explosions of light, or sometimes they have visions, like very complex kind of pictures coming through the mind. I remember once in Oxford, this happened to me during COVID because I've been jogging in a very beautiful area and it was sort of glistening in the early morning sun. And then in my meditation, the same image, but much, much more beautiful came in my mind. And I recognized why it came in, but it was trying to pull me into it, but it was just too complex. There was like this sense of being sucked in, but at the same time, the mind wasn't ready because it was just too complex. So if complex visions come, try to just stay steady. Again, if the breath is still present, stay with that very, very subtle and beautiful breath and just deepen your contentment there, deepen your steadiness. Because sometimes what happens is the visions seem quite meaningful and people give them meaning that they don't really deserve and get a little bit lost. Yeah. And it's just too complex to take you into deeper states of meditation at this time. So the types of nimittas that are really helpful for the meditation are nimittas that are steady, stable, and very beautiful, very bright, and that remain for a while. And that leads us on to the second part of this tetrad. When you learn to brighten the nimitta or bring joy to the citta, abhipamojayam cittam, literally means bring joy to the citta, to the mind or to the nimitta, as you breathe in and out. And when you learn to settle the nimitta, still the citta, as you breathe in and out. So these two aspects are here, brightening it or allowing it to brighten, rather, and allowing it or learning how it settles, how it becomes stable and still. And always the way that it becomes stable is to keep the mind still, because the nimitta is just the mind. Yeah, it's just learning to stay still inside. And the way to brighten, one of the very powerful ways, is just to again stay steady and allow things to brighten on their own, but not to analyze it, not to kind of check out, okay, how big is it? Where are the edges? Which parts are brighter? Which parts are duller? Don't go there. Just allow the mind, if it does notice, to go to the most beautiful part and to stay with that. the thing is, all these sorts of tips may help, but the best tip of all, I feel, is to do absolutely nothing. Because at this point, the mind is so sensitive. And the reason these lights are arising is because the mind is very still. So if you then get your sticky fingers involved and you start to grasp at these things, or you start to think, what next? The whole thing just collapses and falls apart. The nimitta, Ajahn Brahm likes to say, is very shy. So if the nimitta, the lights in the mind, know that you're there watching and getting involved, they'll just vanish. And I've had this happen, you know, where it happens almost immediately. Something comes up, ooh, and boom, it's just gone. It's like literally a flash. And that's because the mind's not really ready. So don't worry about it at that point. Just stay with your practice, stay in the present. Sometimes it can kind of disturb the mind a bit, but then just re-establish that present moment awareness and re-establish that sense of contentment, that sense of peace, and just allow the meditation to continue. It doesn't matter if these things don't come back straight away. It's, again, putting the causes in place over a long period of time. And there will come a time when that mind and that nimitta does brighten and become very, very steady. And then the fourth stage of this particular tetrad happens. And this is when the mind is released. When you learn, Ajahn Brahm's made it very black and white here. Okay, so the Pali means vimochayam chittam, when you learn to liberate the mind. But he's just said, basically, when you learn to enter jhana. But that's what it means. Abhipamojayam chittam is like brightening the nimitta. And then vimochayam chittam literally means liberating the mind. The vimokas in the sutta always refer to the jhanas. So the word mokha is like the Hindi moksha, or the Sanskrit moksha, which does mean liberation, but they're basically talking about samadhi. Yeah. In the Hindu teachings, samadhi is considered liberation. So these are the states of jhana. When you learn to enter jhana as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you're mindful of the citta of the mind, having restrained the five hindrances. And now it's not just restrained, you've overcome the five hindrances at this point. Energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. Okay, I do not say that there is development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull, who is not fully aware. In other words, it's not possible unless you reach the jhana without the hindrances gone. That is why, on that occasion, a meditator abides mindful of the mind, or the citta, having restrained, I would say abandoned at this point, the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. So, interesting translation. I do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull and who is not fully aware. And I think the point that Ajahn Brahm is trying to make here is that the jhanas are not states of dullness or lack of awareness. You're not zoning out. You're not in a trance. These are states of heightened awareness with the hindrances completely gone. So mindfulness is actually as strong as it's ever been. It's incredibly strong. And this is why when you emerge from those states, as Bhantinita was saying at the end of the gradual training, the mind is so unbiased, so strong and stable, and in a way very daring, very bold, that it's able to see things it's never seen before. It's able to look at areas of experience that we don't want to see, like impermanence of this body and mind, like the fact that there's no abiding self within what we take to be a self. It's just a process. We don't want to see that when the mind is fragile, when we don't yet know who we are. But at this point, the mind is so empowered and so full of happiness, full of confidence, and also very, very steady that we can go to those areas. We can look at the five khandhas, the body, the feelings, perceptions, mental volitions, and consciousness itself, or we can look at the six senses, and we can actually see that these things are impermanent, that they're not me, not mine, not a self. And this is even more liberating when we start to see this. This is where delusion starts to be destroyed. So delusion creates suffering. It's in a way the root cause of suffering. And now with the five hindrances overcome, we're starving delusion of its nutriment. The Buddha said that the five hindrances are that which nourish delusion and obscure reality, obscure wisdom. So for the first time, we've got these blinkers off and we're able to see things in line with the Buddha's teachings for probably the first time in our life. And this is where deep insight can arise, not the kind of insight that helps you in your life. It will help you in your life, but not only helps you in your life, but the kind of insight that can lead to breakthroughs into stream winning and beyond. So I'm going to just read the last tetrad because we don't have much time. But one more thing I should say is that after Ajahna, the Buddha actually describes the mind like melted gold. He says that the gold has basically been freed completely from any impurities and now it's fit for work. It's like a goldsmith who's melted that gold, melted it, fanned it, made sure it doesn't burn, and gradually the defilements have gone, and now it's malleable, now it's workable. Now you can direct it into anything you want to. So even if you want to see things like past lives, you can do that. If you want to develop some kind of psychic powers, you can probably do that. Depends on your particular karma, perhaps. But certainly it's possible to direct it to the Four Noble Truths, and to impermanence, non-self, and suffering. Yeah. So the last tetrad then is a consequence of having experienced Ajahna and having heard the Buddha's teachings as well. And this is about wisdom. When you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation, so you've just had an experience of big impermanence, the body disappeared, the hindrances disappeared, the five senses disappeared. And also, you've just exited that jhana. The jhana disappeared. Damn it. Even the jhanas are impermanent too. When you learn to explore things fading away in breath meditation, all those things faded bit by bit when you stop fueling them. When you learn to explore things ceasing in breath meditation, so you've had some genuine experience of cessation to a point. And the deeper you go in the jhanas, from the first to the second, second to the third, third to the fourth, and even beyond that, you'll see how each state ceases and gives rise to something more subtle, increasingly subtle, until everything ceases completely. And lastly, when you learn to explore relinquishing things in meditation. So this is the big letting go. Easy to let go when you've seen that things have no essence. On those occasions, you're mindful of mind objects. Dhamma, that's the fourth satipatthana. Having, I would say, overcome the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. Having seen with wisdom the impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment, and Ajahn Brown's put in here, of the five hindrances, but it can be of many things. You are mindful with equanimity. That is why on that occasion you're mindful of mind objects, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. That is how mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, completes the four focuses of mindfulness. Okay. So that is the teaching in the Anapanasati Sutta in brief. And hopefully that was a combination of some of the teachings, so some educational component and also some practical tips. And again, to summarize in a sentence or two sentences, make sure your foundations are strong. Keep building them throughout your whole life. It's like you want to build a pyramid. The stronger and the bigger that base of the pyramid, the higher the pyramid becomes and the longer it lasts. The pyramids in Egypt are even longer than those trees that Bhantinito talked about. I think 3,000 years old or something like that. Why? Because the foundations are so strong and they can reach even higher, I'm sure, than they do because you've got those incredibly strong foundations. And the next thing is that breath meditation is meant to be enjoyable. If your mind is not ready for it, if your mind is struggling, you're using force, just pull back. You're not ready. That's all. Put in those supportive conditions and remember the importance of developing happiness in the meditation. It's a pivotal point from where the meditation deepens all on its own. So I hope you will enjoy your meditation today.